is The Infinite City, stories from Belfast of people and place. I'm Connor McCafferty.
And I'm Rebecca McCabe.
Shall we jaywalk, yeah?
When in Belfast, you can
definitely jaywalk.
In this episode, we walk a route around the city, following the traces of something that no longer exists, at least not physically. We're following Kate Catterall, a designer who left Belfast in the 1980s. Returning to visit her home city, in subsequent years, she was aware of changes. New buildings were going up, old businesses closing down, and new ones opening in their place. But it was another change that had the biggest impact.
This is not the city I remember. And it's not the place that I recall. It looks different, it feels different. And looking back now, the thing that was different was the barricades. It was open and you'd walk past and you'd remember and you'd step over it in a sort of way. It was sort of uncanny. It's not here anymore. What happened to that? Even though, you know logically what happened, but it feels like it's still there.
On a grey day in June, we meet Kate at the junction of Royal Avenue and North Street. She's home on a visit from Austin, Texas, where she now lives. She's back to see family and catch up with friends. But it's a working holiday too. She's been busy in Golden Thread, one of Belfast's local galleries, bringing people together to do something that is at once deeply personal and dangerously political. To remember the past.
This is Garfield Street and Royal Avenue, and this is one of the streets I was looking at and trying to find bolt holes of where the barricades might have been. It's hard in some places to figure it out. On some of the streets you find one set of four bolt holes at about the right size and height. On other streets you're thinking, is it a canopy or a sign that went up after? In other streets buildings were built long after they were taken down and you can't see, or the buildings have gone completely.
We're following the route of a security system that was installed in Belfast in the early 1970s. It became known as the Ring of Steel. It was a response to a growing threat from paramilitaries who saw the city centre as a legitimate economic target for their bombing campaign.
Well, they were phased in from about 1972, and at first they were very ad hoc pieces of concrete, crowd control stuff that they still use today, but it was all sort of bundled together. And primarily, I remember soldiers being the ones that sort of checked everybody. And the idea was that if you could protect the downtown, commerce could keep going and everyday life, to a certain extent, could proceed. But in fact, it created this odd space where all of the citizenry became both secured but suspects. And it really transformed how I think we viewed ourselves.
The Ring of Steel was a series of barricades, some of which were simply fences and gates that rendered certain streets and alleyways impassable, while others were more complex checkpoints controlling the movement of vehicles so they could be checked at key routes into the city centre.
At the entrance points, pedestrians coming into the city centre were also subject to searches, something like the security checks that have become standard in airports. If you had bags with you, they were searched, and you were scanned with a handheld metal detector before being allowed through the gates and into the city centre.
Every store once you went in, so you go into Boots, which is still in the same place, and you have to open your bag. It made me feel scrutinised and safe at the same time. Yeah. I felt watched. Yeah. And I felt paranoid. Like, am I a bad person? I was only a kid, you know, so if somebody asked me a question, I'd say, I don't know, maybe I did. I'm not sure.
Searches were a routine part of life in Belfast, the accepted cost of a relatively secure city centre. This routine was so normalised for Kate that she found it hard to shake, even when she left Belfast to attend college in Glasgow.
But you leave and go to college somewhere else, you walk into Boots in Sockey Hall Street in Glasgow, you open your bag and everyone, or you stick your arms out to get searched, and people are like, what? You know, there's this echo that comes with you into another place.
Yeah.
And you look like a weirdo.
We head south for a bit on Royal Avenue before turning right onto Berry Street, where we're faced with what appears at first to be a dead end. Like a lot of streets in the core of Belfast, Berry Street has been transformed over the years. Once you could have walked down Berry Street from Royal Avenue to get to the old Smithfield Square, a traditional market area in the city centre.
Today, Berry Street is cut in two by the service yard of the Castle Court Shopping Centre. We'll talk more about Castle Court and how it transformed the cityscape in a later episode. But today, walking with Kate, we saunter down the street to contemplate an imposing red brick wall adorned with artworks conveying nostalgic images of the past.
It has the, you know, aesthetics of a barrier in some respects. It doesn't have the barbed wire, but it does have railings that go up above. And the artwork is a throwback to some other century, because God forbid we talk about anything that happened in the last 50 years. The safe territory is to theme the more distant past. And, you know, these things are sort of noticeable in the urban environment here, that it's not necessarily for us, the locals or the expatriates coming back. It's for some tourist that's been imagined. It's some projection of a reality that I don't recall.
We follow the new Berry Street in a 90-degree bend around the wall of the service yard towards Bank Square. On the way, Kate points out the mishmash of materials that make up the built fabric. Though the service wall has been dressed up with artwork to soften its presence on the area, the street feels very much like a back alley. There are no shop fronts and few windows overlooking the street.
I don't know how tourists respond to it. They probably think, oh, lovely, that's really nice. But it's in a way, to me, it's sort of a lie. It's a projection of not even what we hope the future will be in Northern Ireland. It's more of a negation of what that past was, that immediate past was. And I don't think that's a terribly healthy thing. But I'm an outsider now. I'm an expatriate. I've lived half my life in America. I'm one of those awful Americans that I'd have hated coming home to say stuff.
We cross Bank Square to reach the northern end of Queen Street and a former warehouse that was built in 1919. On a walk that Kate had organised the previous week as part of her research, people identified this corner as the location of one of the barricades.
This nice little building here, which is a sandstone facade, and it's now an art gallery of some kind, platform, but we thought we saw evidence of the attachments right here. Not 100%, can't tell on the other side because there's new fascia over there, no clue. But this is the consensus of the three or four older people, sort of in our late 40s, early 50s. And you look across here and we have some Troubles era infrastructural stuff and layers of urban decay, basically, you know, right in the centre of an area that's being regenerated and sort of concealed and covered up.
Gap sites and surface car parks, like the one Kate points out, are everywhere in Belfast city centre. They are a hangover of rapid depopulation of the city core. Not only the Troubles, but also car-centric urban planning meant that people fled or were moved to suburbs and towns outside the city centre from the 1960s on. Their departure left numerous unused spaces in their wake.
Sites like these are a visual blight on a city trying to reinvent itself and seek a brighter, prosperous future. But even while looking forward, Kate sees value in taking time to reflect. In a city rushing to catch up in its development, there is a risk of removing all the physical traces and connections to place that are still in people's living memory.
But it's sort of comforting to me that there's still some back streets and some lairs. I don't know why. And I've been accused of by a friend. He's like, you're not doing some Troubles era nostalgia thing. And I said, no. I'm just interested in daily life and the fact that your kids have no idea how you grew up. And sharing those sort of stories, using our black humour, our, you know, the funny memories, not all the trauma and the disaster, which was layered in there. But life went on and, you know, you remember sort of weird gaming arcades down here, you know, the 147 Club, where people went to play games, like, all day long. Pac-Man was the thing back in 82 or 83 or whatever.
Walking south down College Avenue, we skirt the edge of the former Ring of Steel. Kate recounts a particularly memorable occasion when she was searched going through the barricades.
A memory of being a young teenager, maybe 13 or 14, and tipping my bag out when I was being searched, and tampons and sanitary pads coming out with your first boyfriend. You sort of die on the spot, bright red, humiliated. And that's what I remember. And I was talking to a woman who trained as a doctor here. She was in Queens, just started Queens in 1969. And she said that the houses of residence kept getting bomb threats or something nearby, and they'd have to come out. She said, I put on a dressing gown, my best nightie, and some lipstick just in case I met somebody cute, you know? Equally well, there were women who I was talking to who were carrying babies and couldn't get through the turnstile with the shopping bag and the wee baby and nobody to help her. And it was just a real challenge on an everyday basis.
The Ring of Steel is now a thing of the past. Belfast has opened up in all kinds of ways, and accessing parts of the city centre now that were out of bounds for her as a teenager still carries some excitement for Kate. Heading east now towards Belfast City Hall, she identifies the site of another barricade, this one at the southern end of Queen Street.
You know, this might be it. Sometimes it's very hard to tell, but it was around here. And then you're in. And some of them were just exits as well. So there were main entranceways in Donegal Place is opposite the City Hall, and up on Royal Avenue and on High Street. Those were the big ones that buses went through, and but you weren't allowed to drive through the city centre. And I remember the first time I drove through it as an adult, I was like, woohoo, look at this. There was a real sense of freedom, you know? And novelty to it, because it was just so unusual. But that's the environment that all my friends' kids have grown up in, thank God. But they can't really connect to their parents and their parents' experience as a teenager, because it's so radically different. And to be honest, it seems very surreal, even to us.
As we walk, it becomes clear that Kate is not simply looking for physical traces of the Ring of Steel. It is just as much about conjuring up the feeling of the time, what it was like to live in Belfast during times of such uncertainty and strangeness.
There was a sense of bravado at the time. We weren't very fearful, especially the children. I was born into it. I was born a year and a half before it started. So it was normal. And it was increasingly normalised for people who were born prior to that. It just was the way it was. And I was actually quite shocked when I was speaking to somebody at City Council. They were saying, I wasn't allowed to come up here. I'm from Portadown. I wasn't allowed to come to Belfast until the 80s. Never seen the place before. We were all terrified of it. The stories, oh, it sounded awful. I lived here every day of my life. So I was surprised by that. Even in the countryside, people were terrified to come up here.
The Infinite City returns in a moment. Hi everyone, Connor here. First of all, from me and Rebecca and everyone at Place, thank you so much for listening. Please keep sending us your thoughts and comments, and if you feel so inclined, leave a wee review on iTunes. Before we get back to Kate, I just wanted to quickly mention the architecture tours that we're running at Place this summer. The tours have all been developed through expert research by knowledgeable guides, and I've learned a huge amount myself over the years going on them. So if you're visiting Belfast or you're a local who'd like the inside track on the city, join us for tours on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. We're starting on the 26th of May with a tour by the architect and researcher Andrew Molloy. He leads a fascinating tour exploring various milestones in the development of the city. We also have tours coming up with the architectural historian Eva McDermott, including Belfast's Art Deco buildings, and we have an architectural photography walk with the architect Aidan McGrath. You can find out more and book tickets for the tours at our website, placeni.org. Now, back to the episode. Walking around the city, Kate's eye as a designer is inevitably drawn to how the city's spaces are organised and the various materials and objects that make up the built environment. We reach Fountain Street, today a bustling pedestrian thoroughfare and once the location of a barricade as part of Belfast's Ring of Steel.
So this is Fountain Street, and beside the Linenhall Library there was another barricade somewhere along here. And it's, you know, this could be an awning, I'm not sure, but on this side the facade has been changed so many times, who knows. But it was round about this point, quite close to the road. But if you look back here, there are layers of bollards today. And then as you get to the edge of the road, there's another layer of fencing that runs, you know, just to stop people wandering out probably. But it is layers of sort of impenetrable metal. Where did they all come from and what are they trying to achieve? I mean, there are layers of them and the pattern doesn't necessarily indicate anything logical.
City Hall, a grand Victorian edifice set among green lawns now open to the public, was designed by Alfred Brumwell Thomas and opened in 1906 at the height of Belfast's linen boom. It's the city's most important civic building, where the City Council sits and from where key strategic decisions about the city are made. For most people who know Belfast, it's what comes to mind when they think of the centre of the city. It was and continues to be the site of demonstrations of all sorts. It lay just outside the Ring of Steel, but had its own security measures.
So we're coming to the front of the City Hall here. And the City Hall, I think in the initial plans for the Ring of Steel, the City Hall was included. But in effect, it was not ever included in the barricade, was always opposite. The initial sort of plans with the loop around it included this. But I think they found it very hard to contain. They thought they'd do that as an independent, discrete thing. And I'd never actually walked through the City Hall until maybe 5 years ago. It was completely locked down. However, the exterior had a privet hedge, low privet hedge around it, not the metal stuff. And I also remember they took away all the trash cans or rubbish bins. So there's nowhere to put rubbish. So either you're very good and brought it home with you, or you threw it down the street, so the street was sort of messy.
Donegal Place, the street facing City Hall, is still a busy shopping area, as it was in the 1970s, though it has been improved in recent years. The pavements have been widened, benches and street trees encourage people not just to enter, but to linger. Large pieces of public art feature too, again hearkening back to a time before the conflict.
Donegal Place, Robinson Cleavers, opposite the City Hall, with these odd sail-like nostalgic Titanic shipbuilding remembrances along here, which are I think relatively generic and meaningless, but don't tell anyone. And then this is the point I think where the barricade was, and last year I came in with chalk and tape, and from old drawings and photographs I put together a measured plan on the ground of where it would have been, where you go through to get your bag searched. Swinging doors here that said no entry on the front, and then the turnstile here. For some reason that word will not come into my head. And so first chalk it in, and then white duct tape, if you can imagine, and the police arrive. We've been watching you for a while. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. We were wondering what you were up to and if you had a permit for that. And I said, I don't have a permit, but... And before I got any further, the older policeman, who was in his 50s, said, oh, I know what that is. Oh, my God. That's a very interesting feeling. And the younger guy, who was 27, said, what is it? It's just some lines on the ground. What are you talking about? And the older one said, you know, in the police station, there are these photographs of the barricades. He said, yeah. And he said, this is where it was, the main one opposite City Hall. And the young guy just said, I had no idea it was right here and how big it was. And, oh, my God. And I thought that if other people crossed this with their grandkids, if it was installed, you know, in metal lines in the ground, you might never notice it. But if you pass it with your grandchild, you might tell a story. Not a miserable story necessarily, but perhaps a funny story like mine about the boyfriend and the tampons, you know. And it brings back the everyday life of the Troubles in sort of interesting ways rather than mournful and catastrophic and traumatic ways. But it allows us a means of talking about it. And I think that tourists might be interested in it as well, but it comes from us
rather than being projected for tourists. And I think that might be an important mechanism moving forward for design and public art interventions.
We continue along Donegal Square North onto Chichester Street, passing another gated alleyway with an aesthetic that suggests it's been there since the 1970s. But we can't be sure.
It's interesting though with the barricades, they became increasingly formalised and less ad hoc. And there are images actually of, I guess, the Corps of Engineers building platforms because your feet got too cold if you were in doing security duty in the winter. The rising cold and hardness of the ground was impossible for you, so they started building wooden platforms to make it a little more comfortable for the people who were doing the security. You could enter and exit through a number of them, but there were certain ones, especially in the smaller streets and back streets, a lot of them were exit only. So you had to plan your route through the city and you had to know, and sometimes it changed. And one woman told me she got stuck in the, say that word, it must
Turns
be,
out.
I got stuck in it once, so I've erased that word from my memory. I'm like, that thing I got stuck in. But she couldn't get out for a long time. She was wedged in there. And eventually a whole crowd of people were sort of shaking it and got it loose. And yeah, so turnstile for her and I, we can't say the word.
We walk back along Chichester Street, away from City Hall, turning left onto Arthur Street towards Corn Market, a pedestrian plaza near Victoria Square shopping centre. We pause for a moment at the large public sculpture, The Spirit of Belfast, installed post-Troubles as part of the area's regeneration.
Arthur Street was another barricade. Somewhere along here, the building on the right, as you face Corn Market, is gone. And the building on the left, we may be seeing four bolt holes. It's possible. And then we're also looking at public art, you know, this sort of well-intentioned hope for the future, rise from the troubles. But it's a sort of appropriated modernist aesthetic that's sort of ambiguous and, you know, not terribly challenging to our own personal history here.
Kate sees public art like this as functioning primarily as decorative pieces. In a city still grappling with its past, this is a missed opportunity.
You could say that some of the pieces, like the fish on the lagoon or Nuala with the hula, are, you know, they cheer the place up. But figurative or abstract modernist pieces are predominating, and I don't think it's an accident. I think that they're easy to access. They're images and conversations that are closed and sealed. This is a symbol, take it or leave it, but you don't have access to it in order to change it. You can take a selfie with it. And it represents the future, and we're talking only about the future now. We don't do the past. We talk about, oh, well, maybe we do the Titanic.
Take a shortcut through Victoria Square, a part of the city where the streetscape of the 1970s has been almost completely transformed by glossy redevelopment. It's youthful and vibrant, full of high street fashion and places serving Mexican, Japanese and American food. We could be anywhere in any contemporary city. Kate reflects on how this newness reconciles with her own attempt to remember a more abject past, and which, by her own admission, feels increasingly irrelevant to young people growing up in Belfast now.
Marking where the barriers were does two things. It allows you to talk about the past, but it also allows you to think, oh my God, it's so much better today. That's so much freer, so much more open. How lucky we are, how precious that is. Let's fight for that. I was working with a group of students who are in their teens, late teens, early 20s, at University of Ulster, and they're like, this is depressing, I don't want to talk about this. It's nothing to do with me, that's my parents, so I don't want to do it. And they had to do it because their professor told them to. And so I got them to start telling stories. And one girl said, oh, my mum was a key holder for a shop. And she used to go down, she was 19, she was super proud of it. She'd watch 9 o'clock news, and if they announced the police needed key holders for such and such a street, she'd be there. And there was a bit of crack, you know, everybody who was a key holder would chit chat until it was cleared. But she felt important, a young woman given that responsibility. They started to spill the beans. and tell all these stories. And one girl wanted to go to a gay pride rally. Her parents were like, no, you can't possibly do that. And she thought her parents were parochial and boring and conservative. And then a couple of months later, they confessed to her, any rally, any demonstration can turn into a riot and we might never see you again. So her life had been constrained by the trouble, but she didn't really understand it. Why? How? And she said that was an eye-opener to her.
We emerge at the eastern edge of Victoria Square, out from under its glass roof and back onto the street. We're standing at the intersection of Victoria Street and Upper Church Lane, in front of the rounded wedge of Biddle's Bar. Kate points out another example of the odd layering of Belfast's history.
Here we're looking at the Jaffa Fountain, the first Jewish mayor of Belfast. This has been moved about three times, and now it's outside the Victoria Centre. It's a big lump of cast iron, a great security piece. and there are bollards on the Victoria Square side and on the other side, the street side. And there are bollards on the opposite side, which is the police station. And then we have some 80s. These walls were put up in the 80s. You can tell by the sort of graphic on the police station, by the sort of graphic diagonal stripes. And they've chosen to keep some of those. So that is a layer of history. I kind of like that one.
As we walk down Church Lane, busy on one side with forklifts moving pallets in and out of Victoria Square's service entrance, and on the other with construction work refitting an old warehouse, Kate gives us some insight into how she came to take on this subject and how her personal memories and her training as a designer combined into a very particular perspective on the problem of memory and space.
I was conscious that a proposal had been embedded in the Bloomfield report on peace and reconciliation and caring for the victims, and I think the priorities really were to care for the mental health and economic welfare of the people who had been directly physically affected, and then people who had been killed, their direct descendants and families. And so I started looking at what had been specified, and what they talked about was a piece of modernist architecture remote from all of the urban areas in the centre, geographic centre of Northern Ireland, where you can imagine school kids being shipped in to think about and talk about the Troubles as a history module 20 years or 30 years from the Good Friday Agreement. And then that focus on victimhood created, I think, a hierarchy, which meant if you hadn't been directly affected, i.e. just went through the barricades, and that was your only interaction with the dangers and the horrors of the Troubles, you didn't have a voice. And your experience was perhaps less valid. And the treatment of art and craft was interesting as well, because it was treated as therapeutic, and things that would not offend would be included. So there was this sort of curation and vetting of what could be said.
Immediately after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in April 1998, what to remember and what to forget became two of the main questions that the people of Northern Ireland had to grapple with. A line had been drawn with the past on one side and the future on the other.
Instead of playing out on the streets of our cities and in headlines around the world, the conflict could be confined to museums, archives and libraries, to only the places we want it to go. There has never been a formal memorial. Where would we begin with such a task? With a past that is so divisive, would a memorial heal us or divide us further?
It's impossible to make a heroic memorial for a civil unrest, war / whatever it was, that there's no winner, there's no loser. What you saw in the years directly afterwards was memorials and monuments to particular people, particular events, that then would be attacked by other people who didn't agree with that perspective on history. And I thought, this is a quagmire. How do you represent, how do you even discuss this event? And I understand why everybody's like, keep away from it, don't talk about it, let's just bury it in the past, it's over, let's move on. But I started to think, well, what would be a way to discuss it? And a mnemonic device, something that sort of triggers a memory in an urban landscape and brings back a period or an event, struck me as a way to talk about it, that it wasn't a memorial any longer, it was a marker. And it's not even a historical marker. It's just a memory trigger that's woven into the environment. And to find a mechanism for that, it took me quite a bit longer to think it through and think about sort of everyday elements in the environment. Resurrect or trigger different memories for each person in the community. There's no state-authorised version. And it struck me like, that might do it. So that's when I became very excited and started to dig in and to create a proposal. There's a concern that, you know, you helicopter in and you propose this and you do this. How could I do this so that it just initiated conversations and allowed other people to think about the mnemonic device as a way of working, as a sort of focus, and let it run? And so the workshops grew out of that and having those conversations and collecting 100 such proposals. Or thousands.
Kate is in the unusual position of being both a local and, to some extent, an outsider. To her, changes that happen incrementally, and therefore invisibly to people living here all the time, are much more noticeable.
It is an outside eye, but it's like any good designer, I'd argue. One foot in the local community and one foot almost like a traveller or a tourist, seeing it as a fresh eye. But being able to compare and being able to ask questions that perhaps maybe a complete outsider wouldn't know to ask or wouldn't feel comfortable asking. That said, though, I feel very uncomfortable doing some of this work. I feel like I'm really, like, who am I to come back here and ask these questions and upset people? But my aim is not to upset people.
Kate and her friend's children are the first generation to be born and grow up since the conflict ended. And while those young people have never known a city enclosed by barricades, they live in a society transitioning out of conflict and which is still divided in lots of ways.
I think the test bed was really coming back for other reasons, or maybe to go to an archive at the Belfast Telegraph or Prone or whatever, and then having drinks and a meal with friends and their kids. And the friends would be asking, what are you doing today? And I'd be like, oh, I was looking for this, this and this down in the archive. And the children here in their 20s would be asking, so you really, really lived that? And you really, Mum, did you see it too? And she's like, of course I saw it. But you've never told us this. She said, I tried to. You were bored. You didn't want to hear it. And so that conversation told me, okay, if it's a special sort of thing in a museum, they'll go visit the photographs and it's over there and it's separate from the lived experience of their parents and grandparents. And while we still have the parents and grandparents generation around, maybe it would be good to find ways for those people, those generations, to connect and discuss this.
The living memory of the Troubles won't last forever. And while the big events, the bombings and the death toll, will make it into the museums and history books, what might be lost in the process of moving on are the experiences and everyday realities for thousands of people during those 30 years.
During the Troubles, I think we became, as a whole society, a little lawless. It felt like that other stuff was going on, the big bad stuff. But equally, well, you know, we'd duck under barricades and be very nonchalant about being told not to go somewhere, often thinking that the bomb wouldn't go off. I'll just go get my bottle of milk and you can do your bomb thing, whatever, you know, and you'd go get the milk. And most of the time it didn't go off, but once it did, you know. And we'd also listen into police radio a lot and became very au fait with military language and codes to know what was going on in various parts of the city, because it wasn't always shared on the news media exactly what had happened and where it had happened. So people were piecing together stories by doing surveillance, you know. But we didn't think about it as surveillance. We didn't actually probably recognise it was totally illegal either. But we did all that stuff. There was a level of subversiveness and edginess in behaviours and recklessness as well. It's like, oh, well, we might get blown up tomorrow anyway, so let's just go bananas and have a great night out. So there was this sort of almost nihilistic quality to it. Might as well live, might as well have some fun. And then the black humour, of course, that everyone talks about. You joke about the most horrendous things, and it seems just awful. But it was a release of pressure, and it was like a pressure cooker, this place. It really was. There had to be some outlet.
Memory has a funny way of embedding itself in places so that it becomes indelible, impossible to separate one from the other. When a place changes, it threatens to take our memories with it. Sometimes at the root of our attachment to place is an anxiety about our own identity. And in some ways, for people who live through that time in Belfast, by not being given permission to remember, they are being asked to relinquish something of themselves.
Cities inevitably change, and as we walk down Castle Lane, across High Street, onto Bridge Street, and back up towards where our walk began on Royal Avenue, Kate sees a city that's changing for the better in many ways. But she also wonders at the unevenness of developments, and worries that the tendency to avoid the past may have unintended consequences.
Why is this area being let to go to rack and ruin? The buildings are quite wonderful. Who's living here? Who's working here? Which spaces are occupied in the place that's getting torn down versus the place that isn't getting torn down? And starting to make arguments for keeping certain things or inserting certain things into the space that evoke histories and memories that are just not themed. And there's sort of an immediacy, an emergency response sort of. It's like, we need to start building, let's build. We'll think about it later, but we'll build it, you know. Or there's a very narrow understanding of a design process, which means we're dealing with the utility of the place, but we're not dealing with the sort of texture of the landscape that the building's fitting into and appropriateness. Or whether it's just, let's try and negate it, let's try and just get rid of the awfulness. And, you know, it was a very run-down place. And I can understand it's brighter, it's breezier now. It's newer looking. New is good. I think the worry is that Belfast would become a themed environment, themed for international tourists, themed as a safe space that's a generic safe space. It looks like every other city, so therefore you don't feel scared here, right? Well, perhaps it shouldn't look like every other city. Perhaps it is different and interesting for that reason. Yeah.
The Infinite City is a production of Place, Northern Ireland's built environment centre. Make sure you subscribe on your podcast app or on iTunes so you can get future episodes as soon as they're released.
If you like what you hear, you can rate us and leave a review on iTunes, which really helps us to reach more people. You can also support the podcast by donating. The link is at placeni.org/theinfinitecity, where you will also find show notes and some additional content.
Tell us what you think via Twitter at Infinite City Pod and on Instagram as The Infinite City.
The Infinite City is produced by Rebecca McCabe and Connor McCafferty for Place, with assistance from Maria Postanagova and Stuart Gray. It is supported by Field & Clegg Bradley Studios and Arts and Business Northern Ireland.